Well, weren't those great announcements by Parker? Now, if you notice the clock, it's almost 20 after, so we may not be able to cover everything today. So I've tried to cover maybe the first 2 points in your handout, but as Parker points out, if you go to our website, prestonwoodexamine.org, you will find all of this material, and I'll probably maybe cover that last third later. There'll be opportunities for that, and matter of fact, that's coming up. But for those of you that are new to the class, you might notice back there they have an Ask Kirby card, and I've had quite a few of them wanting me to address this issue, the Harbinger or the Shemitah. Now, some of you are going, I have no idea what that is. You will in just a few minutes, because those are best-selling books. But a lot of what we do here is driven by your comments or questions, and we certainly have had a lot. And I waited for this because some of the events that are described in these books supposedly are going to happen in the month of September, and this is the first Sunday in September. So for those of you that don't know what we're talking about, I'm going to give you a little bit of introduction, and then for all of you, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about how to think that through. What is the name of our class? The examine class, and it's based upon the book of Acts. It said that the Bereans examined the scriptures to see if it was true. And so we're really going to look at some scripture passages. As a matter of fact, you might want to turn to Isaiah 9. We're going to get to that in just a minute. And I will take you through some of this. But these are based upon some of these books, and I'll put those on the screen here. The Harbinger by Jonathan Cahn, which was a New York Times bestseller, was number one for Amazon in different categories. And then a more recent one, The Mystery of the Shemitah. And again, some of you are saying, okay, I have not heard much about this. Others of you have read the books and wonder what I'm going to say. So we'll see if we can get into that. The Harbinger is really a series of signs. It's about a series of signs that Jonathan Cahn, a Messianic Jew, has talked about. And he believes that many of those manifested themselves 14 years ago in what? The attack on 9/11. He uses a fictional narrative, and I'll get more into that in just a minute. But at the same time, he says that what is contained within this story is real. So I think that's important to recognize, that sometimes people say, well, it's just a story. Yeah, it's a story, though, that he believes really applies to America today. And so that is certainly one aspect of it. It was released, as I pointed out, in January 2012, became a best-selling book, had the number one ranking in the category of Christian Bibles and books in the fiction category, also was number one in the religion and spirituality category. So even if some of you are saying, I've never seen the book, a lot of people have seen the book, and a lot of people have read it. WorldNet Daily, a good friend of mine, Joseph Fair, who started WorldNet Daily, created a two-hour documentary, and then later there was another documentary, which actually comes with a book. There's a DVD that goes with it as well for the Shemitah. And that brings me to my second book, and that is the second we're going to look at briefly, is a book called The Shemitah, and it really builds upon some of the concepts that were in The Harbinger. You find that in Chapter 17, but basically expanded what was Chapter 17 in The Harbinger into another book called The Shemitah. And this one documents the warnings and judgments of God against the United States according to what he says is a seven-year cycle going back many decades. The one we probably won't have time for is the third one on there, and that's the four blood moons, of which we've had these lunar eclipses, and the last one will take place here at the end of the month. And so you have all these things coming together for September 2015. So that should get your attention, right? And so that's why we're going to spend some time looking at each one of those. Well, the first book, as I mentioned before, is The Harbinger. And its purpose, he says, is to call America to repent. Really repent for turning your back and turning its back upon God and moving away from the foundations upon which it was built. Turn with me, if you would, to Isaiah 9. And he uses at least two verses in Isaiah chapter 9, verses 10 and 11, as the context for this. There are many other verses, but those are the ones we're going to look at. And in Isaiah 9, verse 10, the bricks have fallen, but we will build with dressed stones. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will put cedars in their place. But the Lord raises the adversaries of Rezin against him and stirs up his enemies. And he says that this particular set of verses applied obviously to Israel, but the principles transcend the Old Testament into the New Testament and also can apply to us today. The harbingers are these various kinds of warning signs, and his argument is that they're various warning signs that God has brought to America, just as God used these warning signs for Israel to actually show them of an impending destruction or judgment. The first one is the breach, and you can kind of see where he gets that, the breach. You know, the falling of the tower, the World Trade Towers and the bricks, the terrorist, number two, the fallen bricks, which is another part of that as well, number three, the tower, the Gazit stone. Then the sixth harbinger is the sycamore. The seventh is the Erez tree. You might say, what's an Erez tree? Well, that's the Hebrew word for cedar, which we see here as well about the cedars. Then the utterance and the prophecy. And so the argument in this fictional book is simply that we have seen this before in Israel. And is it not possible that God is warning us today in the United States of America? Now, one of the things you'll find is a lot of people that have read this book said a lot more about it than Jonathan Cahn does. If you go out and look at some YouTube videos, he's going, wait a minute, you know, you're making statements I've never made. I'm not making those statements that God is going to do something or God has to do something in September. So that's the first thing to recognize that, as I oftentimes say, Lord, spare us from our followers. Sometimes our followers take things in ways that we never mentioned or intended, and that is certainly the case. But let's, again, get into some of the questions that people have raised, and I think there's some good questions. Isaiah chapter 9 basically applies to the northern kingdom. The context is very simple. It applies to the northern kingdom in the 8th century. Everybody would accept that. Jonathan Cahn would accept that. The question is, can this now apply to other nations like the United States? He attempts to say this, that this is like a sign to America. This is not necessarily a prophecy, but it's a sign, and it could be something that we would see. And so these harbingers, which applied certainly to the nation of Israel, could also apply to America. And that is the case. The difficulty that many people point out is, look at the first of 7 verses of chapter 9. It talks about people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. It talks about the yoke of his burden. It talks about the fact that for unto us a child is born, to unto us a son is given. The government shall be upon his shoulder. His name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. What is that talking about? Jesus, right? Okay, these are what are called messianic psalms, or messianic prophecies, I should say, but again, some of them are in a psalmic focus, especially since it quotes for some of those. And so the context is northern kingdom, and in preceding it is, of course, some of the messianic prophecy relate to Jesus. So again, the warnings are there in a sense that there is going to be judgment, but also a lot of people see that verses 8 and following are really a promise to the nation of Israel that even though there will be a judgment, there is still a promise for Israel's future. And we've just seen this because Pastor Graham has taken us through the book of Revelation. And we believe that there will be a time in the future where there will be Israel will receive those final promises, and God will be dealing with that nation once again, which now we believe is even more likely since 1948 we actually have a nation of Israel. So to me, that's more of the context of that. And of course, that's a question that people have asked. Now, Jonathan Cahn says, look, I'm not a prophet, but the message is kind of prophetic. It's not like he's just relaying a message. He's kind of the originator of the message. And even in the book, he talks about the fact that each seal unveils a prophetic mystery concerning America and its future. And so again, even though he says, I'm not a prophet, this is kind of making a prophetic kind of statement in the future. And so that's certainly one of the questions to ask. As I mentioned before, it is a fictional book, and so very interesting fiction. And of course, when you read the Da Vinci Code, a lot of people say, well, that was fiction, but it was based upon some perspective about the Bible. This one is fiction, but again, you have to ask, well, where does fact and fiction blur? Because in some interviews, I've seen Jonathan Cahn say, well, about 90% of this book is true. Okay, well, that makes it much less of a fiction book. You have two characters, Nouriel Kaplan and the Prophet, they're the primary characters, and you wonder, are they purely fictional characters, or do they represent real people, or do they represent some of the ideas of Jonathan Cahn? So that's another question that people have certainly asked about that. And then, of course, there is one place here, and those of you that read the book, where he has an individual where Kaplan has this dream where there's a dedication of the temple by Solomon, and then he turns around and becomes George Washington. Okay, that's a little interesting. What that means there is kind of intriguing about how that is. And again, it's a dream. And, you know, if you're writing a fiction book, you're allowed to have all sorts of fictional ideas. But does that represent any kind of reality, dream? Good question. And Jonathan Cahn hasn't really dealt with that. But the big issue, and I think the foundational issue that a lot of us are thinking about is God going to remove his hedge of protection around America? And that, I think, is the argument of this book, as well as the Shemitah, as well as some of the ones, and if I'm doing pretty well, I might be able to get to that third point on the four blood moons. A lot of people are saying, is there a hedge of protection around America that God is going to remove? Okay? Well, let's go back and again apply scripture for just a minute. You don't necessarily need to turn to the book of Job, but in Job 1:10 is one of the few times we see this idea of hedge. And that is, remember when Satan is talking with God, and God says, look at my wonderful follower, very righteous man, Job. And so then Satan says, well, of course he's going to bless you. Of course he's going to honor you. Of course he's going to worship you because of all his wealth and all of the blessings. But if you remove the hedge, so there sounds like there's at least a hedge that protected Job. And so we can see that. That's one time where the word hedge appears. Now, you're already at Isaiah 9. Just go left a little bit to Isaiah 5:5. You'll see the other place where we see the word hedge in the Old Testament. And that's in Isaiah 5:5. And here is where the judgment is indeed coming down, of course, on Israel. And in 5:5 we read, and now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge and it will be devoured. I will break down its wall and it will be trampled down. So you do see the word hedge, but in both cases, either it relates to Job or to the nation of Israel or to the vineyard or to the kingdom. We do see a word hedge in the New Testament in some of our translations. Most of us, if we use ESV, actually says the fence. But you don't really have a lot of scriptural merit. I'm not saying that we don't, but you don't have a lot of merit to say that maybe there's even a hedge of protection around America. But if there was a hedge of protection, he's saying that now it's being removed. That way raises some questions historically, because there's some other times when America's been attacked, hasn't it? You know, you can think of the Revolutionary War. We can say, well, that was before it was a country. Okay, how about the War of 1812? There's a good example there. I mean, the British sailed up the Potomac. They took over and burned the White House. Of course, the battle at Fort McHenry is from where we get our Star-Spangled Banner. If that one doesn't do you, how about the attack on Pearl Harbor? And I can come up with others, but it seems to me that, again, if indeed there has been in the past a hedge of protection, maybe you could argue that, well, we protected us from really major disasters, as what happened to Germany and Russia in World War II. But at the same time, that's another question that certainly surfaces out of the Harbinger. But nevertheless, whether you accept the Harbinger or not, a lot of people say, well, don't you think we're headed for some kind of economic collapse? Yes, and I don't have to read that book to look at $18 trillion of debt to come to the conclusion that we might have a problem here in terms of even the kinds of possible attacks that could happen economically, or terrorist attacks or others. And it seems to me that we should pay attention to those as well. But after he published the book, The Harbinger, a lot of it had to do with the Shemitah. So he actually produced a second book called The Mystery of the Shemitah. And in that, you have something very intriguing as well. The Shemitah is the Sabbath year. You might remember this, that you were to actually farm for 6 years, and on the seventh year to do what? The land was to lie fallow. And the promise was that in that sixth year, there would be an abundance that would allow you to carry through that seventh year. And there are those that practice a Sabbath even to this day. Don't try to go to Chick-fil-A today, Sunday, you know. So, I mean, there are certainly the 7 days, 7 years, and those kinds of things. Again, the sabbatical year was specifically given to the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. But again, Jonathan Cahn wants to say, well, even though it applied to Israel in the Old Testament, some of these Shemitah principles apply to us even to this day. And so, again, he's pointing pointing to something and does this quite well in the book, and there are others that have done this as well, that if you look at the financial market, you know something kind of intriguing, and that is some of the great crashes tend to take place at the same time of year with some regularity. And one of the things that he has pointed out is that if you look at the seven-year cycle of the Shemitah cycle ends this month. And so then you're at the end of that seven-year cycle. But then you have something even more intriguing. Do I have it on the next slide? Yes. September 2015 is not only significant because it's the end of that seven-year Shemitah cycle, but then it goes into a super Shemitah. Is this confusing anybody? Or I hope everybody's following this pretty well. In other words, you had, in the Old Testament, you had 7 years, and you'd have a sabbatical. But then when you have 7 sabbatical years, that would be 49 years, you'd have what? The year of Jubilees. Everybody remember this? And so this is what he calls the Super Shemitah. So he's saying, okay, when we come in here to September 2015, we not only are at the end of that seven-year period, that Shemitah, but now we enter into the year of Jubilee, or the Super Shemitah, which will go from now to September 2016. If nothing else, you can see why a lot of people said, well, I'm going to pay attention a little bit more to September. You know, we make some jokes about, you know, we're not going to do anything significant until after September 13th, and all those kind of jokes that we make, you know, about this. But again, you can see this. But again, let's be fair to Jonathan Kahn. A lot of people have taken this and said, we're going to have a crisis before the end of this month. I'm not suggesting that you go buy guns, although we seem to have quite a few in this class, I found out now, and buy gold and head off to Montana. But, you know, at the same time, you can see why some people have taken this and gone much further than even Jonathan Kahn has, because indeed that is the case. He has pointed out, now nothing has to happen, but he says if it follows the course, here's what would happen. Now here's something interesting that comes from some others. They, and this is now, I'm moving away from Jonathan Kahn for just a minute. There are some others that have noticed that if you look at that seven-year Shemitah cycle, 4 of those, or 28 years, those are some really interesting cycles. Let's go back to 1917. This is, of course, when America rose to power in World War I. A lot of people say that we became one of the great superpowers at the end of World War I. Okay, add 28 years to that, and you come up to 1945. Now this is the end of World War II. Japan surrenders. We're kind of at the pinnacle of our military power, but also as the establishment of some things economically. You had what were known as the Bretton Woods meetings that took place up in the New England area. Some of you actually have been to that place. And this is where they established everything from the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. This is where they also decided to have the dollar actually be the reserve currency. It was tied to the gold standard. That's back when our dollar was as good as gold. You had the establishment, many people say, of the New World Order. So that's 28 years. 17 plus 28, 45. Okay, let's add 28 more to that. That takes you to 1973. Well, that's where Richard Nixon closed the gold window. We were no longer tying the dollar to the price of gold. So we went off, if you will, the gold standard. This, of course, is when all of the things that were implemented 28 years earlier during Bretton Woods began to unravel or collapse. It's, of course, the year in which we legalized abortion. It's also the year in which the American Psychiatric Association declared homosexuality was not a psychological disorder, but an alternative lifestyle. It's when we lost the Vietnam War, and it's when the World Trade Center was built, interestingly enough. Go 28 more years, what do you come up to? Well, that's when the World Trade Center towers fall. We have a stock market crash and the rest. If you had more 7 years, of course, you got to the stock market crash there as well. So you can see why some people are saying, well, is there something significant about this seven-year cycle? What's the rest of the story on that one? Well, something to think about. First of all, we recognize that the law of Moses did require Jews to cease from their work on the seventh day of every week. God also, of course, instructed Israel to observe a Sabbath year. So he'd work 6 years, and the seventh year was to rest. And so this was not only an agricultural function, but it was also an economic one in which they would forgive those debts. And so disobedience to that led to what? Well, it led to the Israelites being taken captive. You lose the northern kingdom and it's destroyed. The southern kingdom is taken to Babylon by disobeying that. So Jonathan Cahn's argument is not only was this to be a blessing to Israel, disobedience to it could be a curse to Israel. So he argues now that sometimes the Shemitah could also be a curse or at least a harbinger of the future. But again, difficult to say how that would apply to the United States. Are we as a nation supposed to follow 6 years of work and a seventh year of rest? Okay, so that's a big question, you know, how does that does? And again, if indeed that was the case, you could see that certainly it applied to Israel, but would God impose a Shemitah-type judgment on other nations? And that's, of course, a big question that people have had about that as well. Now, he tends to connect Israel to America by saying, well, if you look at the founding of this country, that's really what they claimed. And I think it's fair to say that if you look at the Pilgrims, and especially the Puritans, they really saw this as the new Israel. And he's got a chapter in here called The Israel of the New World. And so they really wanted to establish this as a city set on a hill, as Israel of the New World. True, but by the time you get to the founding of America, you don't find that as much. You know, you see a lot of individuals that were part of our founding that are not exactly evangelical Christians. Thomas Jefferson certainly doesn't fit in that category. Benjamin Franklin does not. He makes a big deal about the fact that George Washington preached in a church, which is today where the Wall Street Stock Exchange is located. True, but you know, he actually was sworn into office on a Masonic Bible, and actually it's the Masons that have used this to actually endorse that. So, you know, it's just a little tougher to make that connection between Israel and America. And so that is certainly the case. But one last one, which I thought was kind of interesting, is that there are people that are now, and have been for some time, raising the question of whether or not we've got the right Hebrew cycle. In other words, do we actually have, is the Hebrew calendar that we're using right now, that the people in Israel are using, is that the same one as the Old Testament? And one of the individuals that has raised that question is a man by the name of Dave Reagan. If you've not seen his television program, he broadcast up here from Princeton, Texas, and it's kind of interesting. He's a graduate of Harvard's, but he actually lives in Princeton, Texas. But anyway, that's a different story. But he's a prophecy expert. But years ago, he pointed out, interestingly enough, that we may not have the right Hebrew calendar, and yet he's had Jonathan Cahn on his program and agreed with him, but I thought it's kind of interesting. You're on the program with an individual that's really questioned the whole Hebrew calendar in the first place. So that's another question about whether we actually are into the year of Jubilee. If we are, then September is really significant because, as he has said, we come to the end of Shemitah and we enter into the Super Shemitah. And I guarantee if anything happens this month, everybody's going to say, see, see, see. So we'll have to see where it goes. But I was able to go fast enough so we can finish our last one here. And that is, if this isn't enough, we'll move away from Jonathan Cahn to the fact that a lot of people have pointed out something else is very significant about September 2015. And some of you have seen parts of it, but I've added a little bit, and some of you have not seen any of it, so let me do some basics on that. And that is, we've coming to the end of what is called a tetrad of four blood moons. John Hagee has written about this, and Mark Biltz and some others, and they all point out something very intriguing. And that is that back in April of 2014, we had a blood moon. Now, what is a blood moon? Well, it's a lunar eclipse. I could bring Parker up here and he could explain it even more detail, but as the Earth comes in front of the moon, as the sunlight's coming here, the long spectrums, the red spectrums, go across easier, so the moon looks like it turns red. And so we got our first blood moon, and it didn't just happen arbitrarily, it happened during Passover. Then we had, this time last year, we had our second blood moon, and that happened during the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, then we had a solar eclipse, and this is why you need to come out to day four to see some of these things, right? We had that one last March, then we had the third blood moon of April during Passover, and now at the end of this month, on the 28th, we will have our fourth blood moon, our tetrad of blood moons, and this one will happen during the Feast of Tabernacles. That's pretty significant, isn't it? And there have been a few people that have pointed out that when we've had some of those other types of blood moons in succession, some very significant things happen. One of those in 1948. What was significant about 1948? Israel. Now, when I did speak on this in Michigan, there was somebody from Israel who said, you know, the problem I have with all of this, I said, be my guest, is this is supposed to be a sign to the Jews and it's supposed to be a sign to Israel. We couldn't see a lot of those blood moons in Israel. They're much easier to see in North America or in different places than it was there. So that's a good question to ask. You know, if indeed this is supposed to be a sign to Israel, again, you could say, well, because of the news, they would know that. It's not like in ancient Israel where if it happened in England, they wouldn't know it. If it happened in the United States, they wouldn't know about it. But it's a really good question to raise about that. But as you look at this, this has been something that people have felt were very significant. Now, John Hagee, who's the author of one of those books and is a pastor in San Antonio, also, like we've talked about before, has noticed this interesting pattern of every 7 years. And he points out that the four blood moons are significant, but they also happen at the end of these sabbaticals or Shemitahs. So you can kind of see why there's a lot of interest about this right now, because he looks again at the attack on the World Trade Center 7 years later, the economic collapse, and what happens this year? Well, so far, I haven't checked the news in the last few minutes, but I don't think we've seen any collapse or any kind of issue. But certainly you can see why people have paid so much attention to that. So the real question is, what could happen this year if we enter into all that? You know, would America be at war? Would our mountain of debt cause some kind of economic collapse? Will global terrorists attack our nation? And in light of all the things we've talked about here with ISIS and economic issues, we certainly could pay attention to that. But what about kind of the attempt to find this biblically? If you look at your notes there, I can't put down some of the biblical passages. And one of the questions you want to ask is, well, do these blood moons, do they have any scriptural basis? Because again, this is what? The examine class. So let's examine the verses that these men use and see if this is indeed the case. The first one that you see often quoted is out of Joel chapter 2. And you can look that up if you want, but I put it on the screen to make it easy. And that is here, this prophecy given to the prophet Joel said, I will display wonders in the sky and on the earth, blood, fire, and columns of smoke. The sun will be turned to darkness, but here's the key, the moon into blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. So it's talking about the significance of a blood moon. Okay, once again, let's look at the context. Context is king, right? The prophecy here obviously talks about the moon turning to blood, and then it also, in 3:15, talks about the moon growing dark. Now, there is an allusion in Revelation chapter 14, and when Pastor Graham was preaching to that, he talked about the fact that there, the allusion in chapter 14 of the book of Revelation is back to Joel chapter 2 and 3, and so it looks like the context of this prophecy is the day of Armageddon, and it is that final battle that Jesus fights. Well, if that's the case, then these blood moons we're seeing right now are a little bit premature. You know, at best you could say they're a harbinger. Joel 2 says that all these will happen at the same time, a solar phenomenon, stellar phenomenon, as well as the moon turning to blood. And a lot of it seems to apply and be applicable to what is happening during the time of tribulation. So that's Joel chapter 2. What about Matthew 24? Because here, again, Jesus is helping us understand, when will this happen? They're asking him, okay, what if you're going to leave us, you know, and you're talking about this judgment is going to take place, help us understand. And he helps us that these will be like birth pangs. In other words, they will increase in frequency and intensity. Today I was sitting next to a woman who is obviously very pregnant. And the reason I noticed that, every once in a while I could feel her doing this, you know, and she was just very uncomfortable. And I know that when they get time to have a baby, she will know when that is, because those birth pangs will what? Increase in frequency and intensity, right? And so they are using that same kind of illustration here to say that, yes, we've seen some of this before, but we'll know especially when it's an end when these come together. Now, when Pastor Graham was preaching through Revelation 6, he didn't mention this, but I put this on a chart. And again, this chart's available on the website if you want to look at it later. It illustrates to me that Matthew 24 is applying to what's in the book of Revelation. It's not applying to something before, because you see a perfect one-to-one correlation. I found this in another book. I thought it would have been interesting for Pastor Graham to have pointed it out, because if you look through there, you can see that everything that Jesus is talking about in terms of when to know when the end is coming fits perfectly into the book of Revelation. The white horse, the red horse, the black horse, the pale horse, which Pastor Graham preached on, the martyrs, the terror, the preaching of the 144,000. So I think you can say again that the context of Matthew 24 is that. It does specifically say that the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky. Notice he says this is immediately after the tribulation. So again, I think Matthew 24 doesn't fit very well with the four blood moons, if nothing else because it says the sun will grow dark. Okay, astronomy 101. If the sun is dark, what happens? The moon is dark too. Of course, the earth is dark as well, but you don't get a blood moon if the sun is dark. And, you know, unless you want to just say those are clouds that cover it over. And so it seems to me that these, again, are just supernatural events where God is in the final days, just before Armageddon or during the Battle of Armageddon, pouring out his wrath upon the earth. That's why we have to have a new heavens and a new earth. So that one doesn't fit very well. What about Acts 2? In Acts 2, we see Peter quoting from Joel 2 about wonders in the sky, and even talks about the moon becoming blood. And they had had a lunar eclipse at that time during Pentecost, and he alludes back to it, but not saying that that's a fulfillment of Joel 2, but just saying this was going to get your attention about the fact that indeed we are now going to begin, in a sense, the preaching of the gospel. What happens on the day of Pentecost? Thousands become Christians. But again, even if you say that that is a fulfillment of Joel 2, that happened in AD 33, that certainly doesn't point to this year. So I don't think that works very well as well. And of course, I think a lot of it has to do with the tribulation. Again, you've got an earthquake, you've got sun, stars falling, sky splitting, mountains and islands moving, and all the rest. That is the case. So finally, we go to Revelation 6, which is also used as some of these books. But again, as I think Pastor Graham did such a good job of helping us understand, that's with the breaking of the seals, and you have the four horsemen. It does say that the moon will become blood, but it's very obvious that that happens in the future during the tribulation. Well, I was able to get through this fairly quickly, so I'm even going to let Parker ask a question or two, or go out and let you ask some questions. But let's think about our prophetic checklist, because you're saying, okay, you've kind of dismissed all of that. Are there things that tell us where we are in the prophetic clock? Yes. First of all, let's look at a few having to do with the church. Apostasy inside the church. Well, you might say, well, there's always been apostates inside the church. Well, again, go back to that phrase, increasing in frequency and intensity, birth pangs. We are seeing more apostasy than ever before. Yes, I think that's the case. A one-world church. There's always been a desire for a one-world church, but you really see it now coming together in ways that never existed before. You say, there's always been a try to have a one-world church. Yeah, go back and look at the 16th and 17th century. We had religious wars. People were putting each other to death because they disagreed about the mode of baptism. That wasn't exactly a one-world church, was it? I mean, just amazing. The rise of spiritualism. Oh, we've always had the occult, but it seems pretty significant now. So certainly that's the case. What about nations? Well, up until 1948, was Jerusalem the epicenter of world activity? Was the nations focused on that? Not really, not in Palestine. But ever since then, that has certainly been the case. World government. Yes, there was an attempt to have a world government with the League of Nations. The United States did not even join. What about the United Nations? How about Europe now? You have the European Union. You have the World Bank. You have all sorts of things that just, again, are completely unprecedented. When we look at other nations, it talks about in the book of Revelation that the kings of the east, so that could be east of the Euphrates River, so that could be China, it could be many of these other countries, and it says kings, so it could be China and many of those other countries around there, but it says that it would actually put together an army of 200 million. When that prophecy was written, there probably weren't 200 million people in the world. And yet China, along with maybe some of those other nations, probably could put together a nation of 200 million that fight in this valley of Megiddo. And if you come to Israel sometime, you look at that and you realize all the armies of the world are going to be in this plain. Wow, this is going to be something. I'm hoping I'm not there. I'm pretty sure we're not, okay? Middle East, you know, a dominant force, you know. Middle East was not that significant until the discovery of oil. You know, push for world peace and a desire for strong leaders. If a strong leader came on right now and said, I could bring peace, do you think that we would accept them? You can see all sorts of things that are unfolding. What about Israel itself? You know, persecution of Jews, yes, that's happened throughout the ages. But it certainly is very systematic and has been really since World War II, even more so. The return of the Jews to the land, that's unbelievable. Who would have ever predicted that? An ancient language of Hebrew, which is now being spoken in that nation there. Russia being a threat to Israel, probably that always has been the case, but the fact that Arab nations would join with Russia, well, you had a little of that with Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was the leader of Egypt, but nothing like you have now, where the leaders in Iran and in Libya and others are willing to work with Russia, where Turkey is willing to work with Russia. Never have seen that. So, as some people like to say, maybe I'm not going to buy green bananas. But we still have some unfulfilled events, because some people say, well, we're right in the middle of it right now. I'm going to be moderating a debate later this month in which you have people that have different views of prophecy, and I'll mention more about that when it gets closer. But we haven't had the rapture of the church take place for Thessalonians. We really have seen somewhat of a united Europe, but it's a really fractured one. Look at all the refugees sitting in Hungary right now. In some respects, it's a very fractured coalition of the Roman Empire. The rise of the Antichrist, he may be out there, he may not, but you know, we haven't seen him. Russia and the Arabs' attack, which is part of the Ezekiel 38 and 39, the battle of Gog, Magog, Meshech, Tubal, the battle of Armageddon. So still have some unfulfilled events. So the bottom line is that, you know, Jonathan Kahn has been trying to warn us that we need to get ourselves right as a nation. And certainly that is the case. If you'd like to read more about some of the blood moons, Mark Hitchcock, who's one of our professors at Dallas Seminary, has written a book on the blood moons, but his best book is one called The End, which is really kind of his opus on the whole area of prophecy. But it's, I think, important for us to recognize that whether you're using books like this to warn us to come back to righteousness, or better, to use this book to warn people to return to righteousness, there is a real need for us as believers to recognize that we're in the end times. I don't know how close we are, but I do know that we need to pay attention to some of the signs. And I, as I've said before, can already conclude that we might have some difficult times ahead in terms of economics with an $18 trillion debt. I can certainly say we might have some tough times as Christians. Let's think of Kim Davis, who is that county clerk in Kentucky, who is sitting in jail today because she just could not endorse same-sex marriage. And I think we have to recognize that it's really important for us to stay true to God's word and to make sure that we are found faithful and righteous in these end times. Parker?